throne. And this will be in a much briefer form than my earlier remarks, but I still would like to draw on the DuPont legacy to illuminate the concept of self-interest properly understood. A good example was that in 1818, there was a major explosion which killed 40 employees at the DuPont gunpowder manufactory. Without being required by either law or custom, he provided pensions, education, housing, and medical care for the victims' families. Self-interest improperly understood, that is, equated with short-term selfishness or egoism, and perhaps de Tocqueville's terminology would say, why should he care? He also refused to sell 125,000 pounds of gunpowder to the South Carolina nullifiers in 1833 for $24,000 cash. I don't want to get into that with respect to how we stand on that issue in this society, but on the surface, this might simply be a stand on principle rather than profit, although the cynical economist might be able to weave a story of disguised self-interest. We're pretty good storytellers when we need to do it, but not often. The fact of the matter is the choices in this real world in which we live are always complicated, and they're always mixtures of motives. Economics does not predict that the persons always choose the seemingly selfish or the monetary bottom line. Economists say that people maximize their utilities, which you spend a whole semester trying to explain to freshman undergraduates, and they never quite get it right, but it's still behavior which is consistent with Mother Teresa as with Ivan Bosky. People's motives are, in fact, always complex and confused. But Rupke and the social market economy would encourage the bourgeois businessman. Honor, decency, and gentlemanly behavior are to be encouraged, fostered, not just neutrally permitted by impersonal market forces. It is also important to note that Rupke constantly draws on Alexis de Tocqueville. In fact, the humane economy mentions de Tocqueville, Kuhnelt Ledin, and Russell Kirk in the same chapter, and that's pretty good company. Rupke's quote that he uses from de Tocqueville is chillingly topical. Quote, democracy encourages a taste for physical gratification. This taste, if it becomes excessive, soon disposes men to believe that all is matter only, and materialism in its turn hurries them on with mad impatience to these same delights, such as the fatal circle within which democratic nations are driven round, end quote. I hope that I'm not purloining possible quotes from Bruce Rubin's talk. He is currently in the office of the U.S. Senator Spencer Abraham from Michigan and is the author of two excellent books, the first of which is particularly germane to his topic and to our conference, Virtue and the Promise of Conservatism, The Legacy of Burke and de Tocqueville in 1992. His most recent book is The New Communitarians and the Crisis of Modern Liberalism, 1996. The first book contains a chapter with a wonderfully ambiguous chapter title on, quote, Virtue Properly Understood, Tocqueville and the End of Self-Interest. Very ambiguous. He is also argues that the best preserver of the Burke and de Tocqueville type of conservatism is Russell Kirk, and not perhaps Leo Strauss, Eric Voegelin, Michael Novak, Michael Oakeshott, and Irving Kristol. But to illuminate us on the riches and confusions of the concept of self-interest properly and oftentimes improperly understood, I present to you Bruce Fronin.
Thanks, Bill. I appreciate that.
Did I steal your quote?
Huh? No. Worse than that, you found a better one than most of the ones I was going to use. But I've been asked to talk today a little bit about self-interest and the ways it can be understood and misunderstood. And the general applicability of the idea of self-interest to economics and the humane economy should be beyond doubt, really, in this room in particular. Milton Friedman, for example, has defended capitalism on the grounds that individuals acting in their own self-interest within free markets will first make only voluntary, that is free and therefore morally good decisions. And two, that they'll make only transactions that are in their own self-interest, which means, according to Friedman, that they will be efficient, beneficial for themselves, and in the aggregate for society. I think it's important to look at Tocqueville in the course of a convention like this, especially one on the humane economy, for two reasons. First, because Tocqueville has been misused for a very long time by two particular groups, which I would argue are hostile to a humane economy properly understood. These groups are, first, those who misuse Tocqueville in arguing that there is something horribly alienating about economic freedom because it makes us all selfish individualists. A sort of Marxian influence psychology that has taken over for the debunked Marxian economics remains with us. Second, there are those who misuse Tocqueville to argue for the proposition that selfishness is a kind of virtue. I'm afraid of that microphone.
Good reason. I can't hear you quite.
All right. These people argue that greed and factionalism, that is, self-interested groups, are the only proper bases on which we can construct a good society. Society for these individuals being good if it is atomistic but wealthy. It's important to correct these caricatures, both of which, oddly enough, rest on the same very un-Tocquevillian abstraction commonly called economic man, the fantasy that we will always look after our material interests, a fantasy that is, in and of itself, very morally debilitating. But in my view, it's more important to look to Tocqueville in discussing self-interest simply because he gives us a nuanced and very accurate analysis of the ways in which all of us are self-interested for both good and ill, and the ways that self-interest can be addressed so as to promote the public good. In Tocqueville's view, that is, to promote well-ordered liberty within vibrant, active communities. I'd like to make three points here today, then. First, I want to argue that for Tocqueville, self-interest is a fact of life. It's not a good in itself. Tocqueville was no precursor to Ayn Rand. Second, that Tocqueville was both able to see the dark and able to see the bright sides of self-interest. He saw that it can lead to selfishness, or it can lead to mutual affection and support, depending on how it develops. Third, and most important for our purposes, according to Tocqueville, we are not helpless in the face of self-interest. Our choices are not simply to either accept and build on selfish factions or to give ourselves over to some form of socialist tyranny. Rather, we can choose between the vice of selfishness, what Tocqueville called individualism, or even worse, egoism, or the virtue of loyalty and service to the community. It's up to us to determine which form of self-interest comes to characterize our society. How so? Because it's up to us to decide whether we will construct a centralized bureaucracy that takes over the functions properly belonging to local voluntary associations, or to maintain the local self-determination and liberty that are necessary for people to learn that self-interest, rightly understood, entails public service and a profound sense of duty to one's community. So let me begin with Tocqueville's view of self-interest. Let me just quote what's probably Tocqueville's most famous comment on the subject. "Do you not notice how on all sides beliefs are giving way to arguments and feelings to calculations? If amid this universal collapse, you do not succeed in linking the idea of rights to personal interest, which provides the only stable point in the human heart, what other means will be left to you to govern the world if not fear?" Note here what Tocqueville is not saying about self-interest. He's not saying that it is a good to be wished for. Rather, he's arguing that given the collapse of faith, the calamity that he saw going on all around him, the only way to secure liberty is to show people that their own self-interest is served more effectively by well-ordered liberty than by tyranny. Self-interest is a necessary tool by which to convince people to respect what Tocqueville himself called, quoting, the sacred rights of property and of the family, rights which are the foundation of our social order. It was not an abstract idea of universal rights that he was attempting to defend, but the sacred rights of property and of the family, which he saw as the necessary basis to any good life. So, self-interest was useful in Tocqueville's view, given the proper circumstances. For instance, in America, self-interest undergirded property rights, simply because so many people own property. It was therefore in people's self-interest to respect property rights of other people and to ensure that the law protected those rights so that they could enjoy the ownership of property themselves. The self-interest also protected well-ordered liberty simply by keeping people preoccupied. In essence, Americans were too busy looking after themselves to think up the utopian millenarian projects that had destroyed religion, the family, and property in Tocqueville's own France. So it's not a virtue, and it's not a vice. It's merely a fact of life, a stable part of the human heart, a fact to be taken into account in reconstructing a good life in troubled times. Tocqueville's self-interest was not necessarily that grubby, nearsighted greed which most enemies of free markets take it to be. It's merely self-regard or concern with one's own well-being. And the results of self-interest can be quite varied. If one sees one's interest only in economic terms, as the getting of money and other tools of material well-being, then one will undermine liberty and one's own character. As Tocqueville observed in his book on the French Revolution, quoting, craving for material well-being leads the way to servitude. And probably more important, quoting, he who asks of freedom anything other than itself is born to be a slave. Critically here, Tocqueville is making a moral judgment on what self-interest should lead us to value. Those who value liberty only because it can make one's wallet faster are brutish already. They're not just going to eventually be slaves, they deserve to be slaves because they have corrupted their character. More generally, however, self-interest can produce individualism. This is that self-interested withdrawal into one's family and close circle of friends to the exclusion of public life, which Tocqueville, while not referring to it as the same to the same extent of vice as egoism, the ignorance of all other people, still, it was something that Tocqueville considered a vice, because it not only makes the community weaker, thus leaving the government free rein to run everyone's lives, but it also closes up a man's heart. It makes us less good as human beings. An individualist shuts himself up in his own house, failing to make the kinds of contacts and develop the kinds of relationships that nurture the better disinterested instincts. And there shouldn't be any doubt. Tocqueville sought to foster, quoting, the disinterested, spontaneous impulses natural to man. The question, in his view, was how we might foster the better angels of our nature. And the answer, according to Tocqueville, was straightforward, though certainly not easy to put into practice, because the answer was freedom. Quoting again, the free institutions of the United States and the political rights enjoyed there provide 1,000 continual reminders to every citizen that he lives in society. At every moment, they bring his mind back to this idea that it is the duty as well as the interest of men to be useful to their fellows. And here's the key. At first, it is of necessity that men attend to the public interest,
afterward by choice. What had been calculation becomes instinct. By dint of working for the good of his fellow citizens, he in the end acquires a habit and a taste for serving them. Constant interaction with your neighbors breeds civility and public service. Because you have to deal with these people on a daily basis, your own self-interest inclines you to want these dealings to be pleasant. They are an integral part of your life. So, you make repeated attempts to do well by other people so that they will do well by you. And in doing this, you develop and bring out those public-interested aspects of your personality. You develop a taste for doing well by your community. In effect, you come to see the community as your own. You come to love it because it is familiar, to accept its faults, and to revel in its small joys. So self-interest can foster virtue. In effect, by causing individuals to identify their own interests with the interests of family, friends, and neighbors. Spiritually, the concrete mutual interests of daily life, keeping the roads clean, keeping the sidewalks safe, things like this, lead to bonds that make for a spiritual connection that's much deeper, much more important, and much more part of your life. What then about atomism? What about that alienation so many academics used Tocqueville to accuse America of breeding in her people? Again, Tocqueville's answer to the problem of alienation is fairly simple. Though again, it's not one that has any easy solutions. The problem, to be blunt, is again, government. You have a choice, in Tocqueville's view, between a government that protects freedom and a government that provides material security. You can't have both. And if one chooses comfortable slavery, one cannot have community, whatever the claims of those modern-day socialists who style themselves communitarians. Tocqueville explained this phenomenon in his discussion of soft or democratic despotism. By doing too much for the people, centralized governments sap the life's blood, the very reason for living, of the local townships. And this destroys community and good character, because it's only in the families, the churches, the local associations of the townships that men can learn to care for their fellows. Once that ad hoc committee that once gathered to clear the obstruction from the road gives way to the Federal Department of Transportation, the homely virtue that once grew out of self-interest has given way to individualism, to selfishness. Men no longer see themselves as intimately bound to their neighbors, and so lose the habit of tending their common interests, instead becoming mere favor-seeking wards of the states. This is the irony of socialism. It begins from an almost visceral dislike of individualism, if not of the individual himself. But it ends up making us more individualist in the bad sense of being greedy, of seeking only our own self-interest, and of ignoring the needs of our fellows. By the very fact that it takes over the essential functions of voluntary groups of people and of local communities. Perhaps Tocqueville's most enlightening, and certainly his most heartfelt discussion of this problem, appears in his The Old Regime in the French Revolution. In this book, he details the way in which French monarchs paved the way for socialist tyranny by taking over the duties of the local nobles. The French government, already by the early 18th century, took great cares, great pains to tend the needs of its subjects, dispensing charity, doling out advice, and even giving out awards and little medals for good farming techniques. But these duties once fell on the townships that had their own corporate charters, and on nobles who had their own peasants and their own honor to consider. You see, the nobles themselves were actuated by self-interest in the old days as well as the new. But in the old days, their honor and their position in the community, which they selfishly valued, gave them the motivation they needed to interact with and to form bonds with the people around them. Under the absolute monarchy, however, they came to see themselves as mere landlords, whose only interest was in getting as much money out of their peasants as possible, with as much trouble and expense as possible. Quoting, "This led to what might be called a spiritual estrangement, more prevalent and more pernicious in its way than mere physical absenteeism. Landlords and peasants, once allies, became enemies, competing for wealth and for favors from the state." Now, I doubt I have to draw in any detail the modern parallels of this, of what happens in a welfare state, what happens to the sense of charity, what happens to local communities that once had run their own local organizations and now become merely administrative arms of Washington, D.C. The institutions and even the laws, though, for Tocqueville, were not key. They might be kept, Tocqueville noted, but God help the nation and the people if the spirit were not revived through a return to self-sacrifice and duty. For Tocqueville, the institutional reforms could not come first. In the midst of the revolutions of the mid-19th century, he begged his fellow delegates to the House of Deputies. He said to them, "Keep the laws if you must. I think it would be a great mistake, but keep them. But you must change the spirit of yourselves and from there of the people." There is an important sense in which it is the personal example that must serve for everyone in the community and from that community, the nation. We must come to understand, before we can properly reform our political institutions, that the mere pursuit of wealth is not in our self-interest, because it makes us brutish and leaves us ripe for the tyranny that we suffer from already. Because we cannot combine with our fellows, because we are busy chasing after the favors of the state reigns unquestioned. We must love and serve our neighbors if we are to lead good lives and to be good people. But the notion that government can make us public-spirited leads only to disaster. It creates tyrants and brutish, selfish slaves. Tocqueville often despaired that the selfishness of his own age could be tamed so that it might become self-interest properly understood. The chasing after utopia would always be a problem in his view. Now, the particular utopia of socialism has been exploded as an idea. But still we chase after government benefits. People even make economic arguments for these government benefits, disguising them as public interested regulations, which in fact companies are more than happy to accept as public benefits when in fact they see them as barriers to entry for those who might compete with them. The problem really is that in our public discourse, we look to economic man as our example. Reforms, whether they're in the area of antitrust law, whether they occur in the realm of social welfare programs, are important. But they're important because and to the extent that they affect our ability to adopt a language and a way of thought that Tocqueville urged upon us, one which understands that you can't speak in terms of economic man, the man who can lead a happy life without virtue, who can lead a nation, if I might say, whatever his vices, so long as the gross national product grows, and that this will not lead us unfit to govern ourselves. It is only when we accept the notion and the responsibility that goes with it that we have obligations to our community, that those obligations must be fulfilled for our own sake as human beings, that we can not only serve our communities, but serve ourselves. Thank you.